What's up, Wisecrack? This is Show Me the Meaning, Wisecrack's movie podcast. I am Michael. Today I am here with Amanda.
Hey.
And the one and only Lux.
Yo.
And we are, believe it or not, here to discuss a film called Cats. To set up some context for the film, Francis Ford Coppola was born on April 7th, 1939. And Cats came out on December 20th, 2019. I don't know what happened in the interim, but those are the two pinnacles of the history of cinema for me right now. You know about the film. You've heard about the film. It stars tons of famous people. But before we get into it, let's start with you, Amanda.
Okay.
What are your initial thoughts about the film called Cats that actually got made in real life?
It may have broken my brain. I just find myself having like wildly different thoughts. Like, you know what? I'm glad they made that because it was my weirdest movie going experience of 2019 by far. And then sometimes I'm like, was that bad for culture? And then the thing that I really just keep getting stuck on is that this was until Phantom of the Opera, the most successful Broadway musical
wow.
of all time. And then I just kind of come back to, we just fucking love cats. Like, what is it about cats? I've spent all morning like researching why we love cats.
Do you mean lowercase c cats?
Yeah, at that point.
Okay,
yeah.
Just being sure.
Uppercase C is yeah.
The film, I guess.
We don't know how we feel about cats.
Yeah.
I'm all over the place.
Yeah. Lux, give us some insight. What are your thoughts? What were your impressions?
I fucking love this shit. Like, it's obviously like there are technical errors abound. The movie makes no sense, but it's like one of those
None.
Things where like if you just give yourself over to like the insanity of cats, it is so much fun. Also, like, I mean, Miles, we put out that article on Medium that I helped Miles with about is Cats better than Star Wars? And like,
oh boy.
Yeah, for sure. Like, it's at least like dramatically interesting and has like a psychology to it, even if that psychology is like fully fucking nuts. And I don't know, it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's obviously not good, but it's like a Rocky Horror Picture Show, The Room type phenomenon.
Just typed the words Rocky Horror Picture Show in my notes as you were talking, Amanda, because it made me think of like the movie going experience.
Yeah.
When people go see Rocky Horror Picture Show, they get there, they're excited, maybe they have some substances in them before they show up. And it seems like that's been the phenomenon with cats.
That's also true about people going to cats.
Okay, yeah. Everyone I know in LA who saw it was organizing a group outing that involves some sort of legal substance to, I guess, put them in the right frame of mind. We could call it
or the wrong. I've seen a lot of tweets of people who were a little bit too addled to really take in the fine art that is cats.
Well, we can get into this later, obviously, but the movie shows us the dangers of putting too much catnip in the air in a performative setting. Okay, well, we'll get into it, but let's do a recap for everyone. And thanks to Lux for helping with this delightful recap, which means if it's good, thank him, everyone online. And if you hate it, it's all his fault.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Cats, we open on a weird, mostly empty London with a kitty cat moon, and a car shows up. Some people just chuck a sack into an alley. Some cats show up and poke at the sack until its contents spill out and reveal another cat. Guys, a cat literally gets let out of the bag within the first 60 seconds of the movie. This cat's name is Victoria, and much like the audience, has no idea what's going on. I'll interject here and say for the first hour of the movie, I thought Victoria was played by Taylor Swift. She's not. Then the singing starts. The cats, including, I'm going to try to say these names, Munkastrap, the narrator, Mr. Mistopheles, who's a magical cat, we learn, tell her all about what it means to be a jellicle cat, which supposedly, according to this research, is how T.S. Eliot's kid would say dear little, as in dear little cats. The traits of cats include being black, white, small, and of moderate size. I think they're also in this song, sometimes they're hypocritical, and then sometimes they're magical.
Sometimes pedantic.
Pedantic. Oh, boy. Soon after this, they explain the magic of cat names, which never come up again in the movie if you were waiting to see how this lands. This tells us a few important things. These cats are Jellicle cats, an undefined but immensely meaningful term. Tonight is the Jellicle Cat Ball, where all the cats compete to see who gets sent to the Heaviside Lair to start a new life. A choice made by the old wise cat Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy. Whew. It's been a while since I was in an Old Testament class. With this in mind, Victoria is introduced to a bunch of cats. They all explain their whole deal via song, even though the ball hasn't started. We get Rebel Wilson as Jenny Yenny Dots, the Gumby cat, whose performance includes training anthropomorphized mice and roaches, eating a roach while it screams, and shedding her outer skin to reveal a sparkly dancing unitard and moreskin underneath. We also meet Rum Tum Tugger, a horny cat played by Jason Derulo. We get James Corden's Bustopher Jones, the fat cat that eats garbage and gets hit in the nuts. I feel like they kind of fat shame him too, but more on that later. Mm-hmm. Grizabella, who's the former glamour cat, in case anyone made the mistake I did, not grammar cat, glamour cat, turned an outsider after falling in with Evil McCavity, the mystery cat played by Stringer Bell. Her quest to meet every cat in the damn world leads her to meeting Mungo Jerry and Rumpelteazer, who are criminal cats who love making a ruckus and stealing. Lovable criminals, though. While she's out doing this, McCavity, the aforementioned mystery cat played by Idris Elba, is going around kidnapping his competition so he can win the Jellicle Ball. He manages to get Bustopher Jones and Jenny Annie Dots and puts them on a boat with Growl Tiger, the pirate cat. Finally, Victoria gets to the Jellicle Ball, where she gets to see more cats dancing, Ian McKellen's Gus the theater cat revive his glory days. He was so nervous. And the highlight of the whole damn thing, we get Skimble Shanks the railway cat. I did like that part. I do think it's unsafe to dance on a railway track. Everyone's having a great time, but then Gus and Skimble Shanks get McCavity'd, and then Taylor Swift, this is where she comes into the movie, Bomb Ballerina shows up, gets everyone wasted on catnip, sings a song about McCavity and how he's good at crime. One interjection here, if you're good at crime, you don't sing about it with your name. You don't create songs snitching on yourself, telling everyone how good you are at crime. You just don't. If you're good at crime, shut up. Sorry. And then McCavity shows up to threaten old Dot, Deuteronomy, into making him the Jellicle choice. She refuses, gets kidnapped, but busted for Jenny Dots, Gus, and Skimble Shanks. Whew, overcome Growl Tiger, the pirate cat, he walks the plank. Mr. Mistopheles zaps her back with magic, or does he? Victoria gets Jennifer Hudson, we mean Grizabella, to sing her big song. It's so good, she gets to go to the Heaviside Lair, or get sacrificially killed. And everyone is happy. The cats sing, dance. Judi Dench reminds us that a cat is not a dog. That was important for me. There's a weird CGI, Trafalgar Square. The credits roll, and you spend the next few days asking yourself, what has any of this or any of my life meant? And what would Francis Ford Coppola think? That's the movie. We're going to break it down. But before we break it down, let's quickly talk about some of the lovely people that are making this whole thing possible. So today, Show Me the Meaning is brought to you by an awesome sponsor, Skillshare. I don't know about either of you, but in 2020, I want to do better. I want to learn more. I want to focus on the skills I already have, while also maybe learning some new stuff. And Skillshare is an incredible way to do that. It's an online learning community where tons of people come together to make themselves better and sort of take the next step in their creative journey. Now, you can study stuff like graphic design, photography, creative writing, marketing, fine art, music, web development, and crafts. I was looking up some of the classes on writing, and there's one really cool course I'm interested in taught by writer Emily Gould that's a 10-day journaling challenge where you write a little bit every day, and at the end of it, she shows you how to put it together into a story. So if you're like me and you're trying to become a better writer, in 2020, maybe it's something you can do. But if not, there's tons of other options. Now, right now, there's an incredible offer available. If you go to Skillshare.com/wisecrack, you get 2 free months of their premium membership. This is an awesome deal, so I recommend everyone goes to Skillshare.com/wisecrack and looks through the courses, sees what they might be interested in, and make 2020 a year where you get a little better. Okay? So do that and let us know what class you take. I would love to hear how all our listeners are making themselves better, smarter, and more creative via Skillshare. This podcast is also brought to you by Likewise. Once again, I'm just going to talk about my problems. I have the problem of focusing on my writing. Skillshare is there to help with that. I also struggle sometimes with just sitting there and scrolling through my like streaming apps to figure out what to watch, or going through my podcast apps to figure out what to listen to. I don't know if this happens to y'all. Likewise is there to help us, because Likewise is an app that helps us discover what to watch or read next. It works with all the apps and streaming services you already use. You can plug in sort of the services you have. You can connect with friends and family on there to get recommendations. And it even learns like what you like, what you're into. So you can avoid that sitting on the hour at the end of a long day scrolling through Netflix to finally pick the one thing you want to watch and then getting too tired to watch it. But of course, along with content like that, you can get hooked up with books, podcasts, even restaurants. Now, if you were to use it for podcast, you could recommend your favorite podcast. You could go on and say, "Show Me the Meaning" is a podcast that you would want to recommend to your friends and family. Not saying you have to, saying you could. If you download the Likewise app on the App Store or Google Play Store, if you go to likewise.com/meaning to check out Likewise for yourself. So don't be like me. Don't waste time staring at apps for hours. Use Likewise. Find awesome content to consume in 2020. Speaking of awesome content, cats.
Oh, hell yeah. Wait, can I tell you a story about scrolling really quick?
I thought you'd never ask, so yes.
So recently I discovered the app Tubi, which just has like an unbelievable quantity of things to watch. And I was looking for a horror movie to watch with my friends, and I scrolled through, it counts how far into the list you get, and I scrolled through 750 movies without picking anything.
Sounds like you need...
It sounds like I need Likewise in a big way.
You
Likewise.
Need Likewise. I think you need it in like a clinical way.
Yeah,
most of us just need it in a way to make
therapy,
our life
but
better.
Like, Likewise will help.
Well, check with the insurance provider in your state and see if you can get reimbursed for Likewise if you struggle from that sort of neurotic condition. Did you eventually find something to watch?
Yeah, I watched a movie called The Danger Nun, I think.
The Danger Nun. That sounds dope.
It was pretty bad, but it was fun.
Well, speaking of danger, we all watched Cats. We've all had some time to think about it. Let's dig a little bit deeper into the movie. And maybe a good place to start is going a little meta and thinking about the phenomenon of this film as a whole, mm-hmm. what this film going experience has been like, and kind of what these past few weeks have looked like, having the culture of Cats emerge around us. So, Amanda, I feel like you have thoughts here.
I mean, I've read an embarrassing amount of articles trying to figure out how big the Cats are, because it's wildly yeah. inconsistent, or you could even say like surrealist, how they yeah. seem to like they're like smaller than a fork, but they're larger than a Coke bottle. It's very surreal. And obviously the feline sexuality is
too much.
I mean, Victoria is like really, really, like very sexually overcome by every male cat she encounters without exception. She's not very discriminatory. And then Grisabella has this like implied feline prostitution past mm-hmm. that's like...
Is that what that was? That she sort of became like a street cat in the pejorative sense?
Yeah. I felt like it was implied there was some sex worker shaming going on in the Jellicle community. Wow. I thought, Lux, did you get that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that's they have to, and then she internalizes all of her suffering. And then she has to learn the big lesson that she's valuable despite the social stigma.
Well, their leader is named after an Old Testament book that's full of very rigorous rules. So that implies that the Jellicle community is a little bit more Old Testament in their ethical orientation. At least that's what I gathered.
Although, who's he what? The two cat burglar cats.
Oh, they're fun.
Yeah, they're not really, no one's hissing at them.
No, and a lot
I guess because they bother the humans.
Yeah, and and I said this before, but another group of criminals who thinks the best way to continue to get away with crime is sing songs about how good they are at crime and how much they love it. So hopefully none of these people ever go on trial. How old are the cats?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any sense of that? Because I wondered, too, Victoria comes off as a sort of naive child, but then it seems like adult cat men are swooning for her in a sexualized way.
Yeah, there's definitely some kitty cat Lolita shit going on.
I feel like it is fair to say, though, that the age gradient sex-wise with cats works a little bit differently than with people.
There's no age of consent in the feline community.
I feel like it's just like kitten into cat. There's like two ages that you can be.
Sure.
Well, if any cat experts know about consent laws in the feline community, please let us know. Movies at wisecrack.com.
The only like clear cut thing is that Grisabella is past her prime. That's what we're supposed to take, which is like a little weird because Jennifer Hudson, I would say, like, is pretty like in her prime. So yeah. I don't know about that casting. Yeah. Also, like, she really needed a tissue.
Okay, wait. Is a big question for me. Was that real snot or was that CGI snot? I thought that looked like CGI snot.
That is a good question. I mean, that couldn't be real snot. And it didn't seem like they were really into doing practical effects on set. So I would say CGI.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's like two perfect little snarps.
Oh, my gosh. So here's maybe a related question then. I mean, how much... I guess this movie makes us ask the question, when is bad good? Right? Mm-hmm. We've talked about other film examples here. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether it be like... We brought up The Room and Rocky Horror Picture Show. Two films that if they're playing in your town, a bunch of people are going to line up to watch them late at night. So this film to me felt like it was right on that line. In terms of box office, it was a historical disaster. This film lost a ton of money and underperformed. At the same time, it seems like in a certain, I guess largely like Gen Z millennial age range, a good amount of people seem to be going to see this movie and making a show of it. So what does that say about this movie or maybe the way we're consuming this movie?
I mean, I think a lot of like the good bad movie zone has to do with like a sort of sense of earnestness and like honest effort. Like everyone in this movie, no one in this movie is like mailing it in. Like everyone is going 10 out of 10, 100% effort, which is shocking given the movie. But like everyone is trying very hard to do the movie. And so watching it sort of like be insane and blurp itself out despite that is kind of where a lot of the joy comes from. Because like, The reason Sharknado, which was like a designed in a lab version of like good bad movie, never like got the like in theaters party treatment, which Cats is already getting, is that it like it felt too designed, it felt too architectural, whereas this was like they really thought they were going to make a movie version of the musical Cats and people were going to be super stoked about it, which is an insane thing to ever think, but it's true. That's what they were trying to do.
See, I don't know. I've been wondering a lot about it. And also in the context of like camp and whether you can make something that's camp anymore or if we're just kind of too diluted by content. And I almost like the reason I kind of am iffy on this movie is that I feel like it was trying to manufacture campiness.
That's what I wondered watching it. And I think that relates to Lux's point as well. Like there's points at which I thought to myself, surely if Dame Judi Dench is putting on cat makeup and singing songs, that she thinks she's trying to do something good? Because like, when else has Judi Dench done camp for the sake of camp? Or maybe she has and I'm not familiar enough with her IMDb.
She's reclaiming her past, because she was supposed to be Grisabella in the original West End run of Cats.
Oh.
But she broke her Achilles tendon.
Yeah, she broke her, she damaged her inside legs. and so couldn't do it. And so now she finally has her chance.
I didn't realize that it was like meta casting with her. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I keep going back and forth because I feel like they couldn't have possibly thought that people would be earnestly into this, right? Like, I feel like they were trying to go very viral and then make money off of that by putting famous people in like disturbingly realistic cat makeup. But I think
the reason I think that this is like a sincere, like they were like, we've got something here, right? is because it's so the opposite of other movie musical type things that have come out. Like we've gotten really into, like, when we're doing movie musical things, it's like CGI, like photorealistic shit. And this is like way closer to like French extreme cinema than it is to like the new Disney Lion King. Like, they clearly, like, Tom Hooper and friends were all like, we have an idea, and it is a capital I idea, and we're going to do it. And then no one was like, please stop. And so then they did it. And then it was like, oh my God, this is what it looks like and is. Because, like,
yeah.
Like, for instance, like, they nuzzle each other a lot in that movie. Like, mm-hmm. those are just actors in green screen suits rubbing their heads together. But, like, they did it. Right? And if you don't think that, like, Judi Dench or, like, Ian McKellen could just be like, look, I'm fucking Judi Dench. I'm not rubbing my head on this ballet dancer. I'm sorry. Yeah. Like, they have that kind of power, but they didn't use it. They were like, sure, everyone can rub their head on me. It's fine. I'm Judi Dench. I'll present my crotch to Ian McKellen after his theater monologue because I'm a horny old cat. Like, they did the stuff.
Or maybe it's that I, like, am objecting to the idea that camp could be, like, so wildly expensive. You know, it's like, if you have that big of a budget and you make a bad movie, is it just bad? Whereas, like, a camp film, I feel like, comes out of, like, an earnest, low-budget effort to make something good.
That's what I would think, because if you wanted it to be a camp film, you wouldn't have had to spend, what, like, $80 million making this.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
I think the campiness of it comes out of the fact that, like, they spent $80 million on... I think that... For me, anyways, camp isn't related to, like, the numerics of it, but rather, like, the commitment to vision, just, like,
mm-hmm.
and the vision outside the context of broader, like, cultural assumptions of, like, what is and is not, like, good movie stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were like, look, we have this idea. It costs $80 million. We're going to do it, no matter what people say is if it's the way to make movie or not to make movie. We're going to do it. They did it, and they were like, now we have movie, and we share it with the people. And, like, I think that's that idea that they were like, we have this movie, we're going to make it regardless of, like, anything else that happens. That's, like, where the campiness comes to me, because it just so it feels so authentic and, like, true to a vision, even if the vision is fucking bonked out and crazy.
Yeah, and just in terms of grammar, when you just said have movie and do a movie and stuff, it makes me think of when they ask Mr. Mistopheles to, quote unquote, magic her back.
Yeah.
And I just like had to, I just couldn't stop thinking about that as a turn of phrase, like, magic her back. It's like, what does that mean? Why can't you just say, I don't know how else you would phrase it. But to maybe wrap up on this current trajectory of discussion, do we think this is a film that will become a Rocky Horror type thing, where there will be annual screenings where people who are still sort of cat-like child themselves will grow up and with their friends in their dorm room watch this movie and have a great time? Or will we never talk about or think about this film again after, like, St. Patrick's Day 2020?
I just don't think it has, like, the purity of, like, a truly disastrous, like, The Room,
mm-hmm.
I think. But I think Lux disagrees.
Big time. I think it 100% is going to be one of those. It already is one of those movies. Like, there are already theaters that are having, like, rowdy screenings where everyone can go in and yell at the screen and dance around. I was in a theater that wasn't even, like, an explicitly rowdy screening, and people just got up and goofily sang along to songs in the middle of the movie in, like, a normal screening. And were, like, goofing around, like, in the aisles. Like, it is already doing all the shit that The Room and Rocky Horror Picture Show took years to, like, become. And I think that it was super fun, and people, like, know that it's super fun. So, like, the Alamo is having screenings of, like, come goof around to Cats. It's time for cat goofs. Like, they already, it's already a thing that exists. So, like, I don't see why it wouldn't continue. And I got that vibe while I was watching it, too. Just, like, so, okay, it's important to note, I watched it in two very separate settings. I watched one, like, at, like, an AMC type thing, and that's where everyone was, like, going buck and getting into it. And I watched one at the Alamo full of people who, like, really take Cats really fucking seriously. And like, both sets of people seem to have a great fucking time. Anyone who is in between those things seems to not. But, like, that's how you get this kind of the movie, right? Is, like, there are people who, like, earnestly love it, and there are people who, like, love the sort of goofy ambiance of it. And as long as you have enough of those people, it's, like, worth it to do. I mean, not make the movie, but to, like, keep screening it.
Wow. I have some bullet points here. Does anyone have, like, a certain theme or part of the film they'd like to discuss? No pressure, but...
Well, I've just been thinking a lot, because while I was watching it, I kept just getting really confused. Like, am I watching a person play a human-like cat or a cat-like human or, and I was just thinking about like anthropomorphization and zoomorphism. How do you, you know, the opposite of it when you make a human like an animal? And just thinking a lot about like our, I feel like the film just really encompasses our over identification with cats and the way we like project lots of human qualities onto them. And I was reading about it, and a lot of it actually has to do with the fact that cats, because they never became like dogs, most dogs are bred like by humans, but cats generally breed wildly because they don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
And so because of that, cats are still like very, have a lot of distinctive like mannerisms, and they haven't been bred to like appeal to humans the way like dogs have eyebrows that like make you want to feed them.
Yeah.
But cats remain like inscrutable, and as a result they're like a perfect blank canvas for us to like attribute lots of human traits to, which I think is why people really dig cats with a capital C.
And it is interesting because we've made so many dog movies where we like simply just like have dogs running around in human voices. Have we ever made a dog movie where people are dogs? I don't think so.
That would be, I don't think it would work.
Yeah. So no, I think that's a really interesting point, that this is a product of our weird fetishization of cats, rejection of our desire to make them like us.
It's also part of Andrew Lloyd Webber's weird fetishization of like making people into stuff. Right. Cause the play after Cats was Starlight Express, where everyone is trains, right?
People are trains?
Yeah, everyone's trains, and all the actors have to wear roller skates.
Stop. How have I never heard of that?
Wait, okay, yeah. Quick aside, he made a play called Starlight. So, basically, Andrew Lloyd Webber wanted to make Cats. Everyone was like, no, you fucking psycho. That's a crazy idea for a play. And then he made, I forget which other one, and everyone was like, well, now you're a famous guy, so you can make the Cats one. He was like, what about my trains one? And they were like, oh, absolutely not. And then Cats was like the greatest hit of the century of all time. And everyone was like, fine, make the trains musical. So Starlight Express is about this boy who dreams about trains. And then like all the trains have like, there's boy trains and girl trains. And there's like each one has like a perfect pair that they can like pair up with to win the race. So all the boy trains like sing their song to the girl trains so they can get together to win the big train race. And there's like a weird train god who never shows up. So it's like weirdly agnostic on the question of if there is or is not really a train god. And then I think the trains like rebel against the dreaming child because they want to like wake up. I can't remember at the end. But my point is that Andrew Lloyd Webber is really into like taking things that are decidedly not human and like asserting a bunch of human qualities onto them. That's like a real Andrew Lloyd Webber move.
Wow.
The only other thing I've seen in recent years that does that is Sausage Party.
I was going to say Cars.
And Cars, yeah. I guess that makes more sense. But no, but in most cases we do this in animated films, it tends to work. It's cute. But when a person is a train or a person is a cat, it just feels weird.
I will say the other fact about this that's relevant is, so T.S. Eliot's little book of shit with his dumb child was
children.
Okay, would it be called, was included not just Jellicle cats, but also Pollicle dogs. Pollicle dogs is a portmanteau for poor little dogs. And those were like anthropomorphized dogs with like little bindles and like overalls that would walk around. So there is like some, there's like, they're the same at base, the same principles are applied to both dogs and cats in like the very original text.
I was reading about this morning, and I think that he was going to write more about the dogs, but he didn't find dogs as interesting. So there's like one poem with dogs in them, but like there's a million poems about individual cats.
Yeah.
So it also is like, It's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's harder to think about creating real character tension with dogs because they might disagree for 2 seconds and all like join the team together and try to solve a mystery. Whereas cats are so, they just come off as so individualistic. It's easy to build that sort of tension, I guess.
Yeah, I even read that like cat owners are more likely to say that their cat is like an individual and is very unique. And dog owners are more likely to be like, I love dogs.
Yeah, I feel like until recently, this has nothing to do with the film, so I'll say this and stop. But until recently, dog owners got that dogs are dumb and just like accepted, like they're dumb, but they look cool and are fun. And like the past 5 years, now everyone's dog is like special and smart and great and always on every plane with them. nothing to do with this film. Lux, was there any themes or ideas that you're thinking about over there?
I mean, A couple things that just jump out immediately are, like, it's worth talking about. So did you guys see it pre or post, like, patch? Like, when they, like, post video game style patched the movie to, like, fix a bunch of tech problems.
Ooh, I'm not sure.
I saw it before. Yeah, cool. I think okay. I saw Human Foot.
Because for those of you who don't know, this happened. The movie came out and was, like, not finished. And they were like, we are going to send out a new digital cinema project or projection to all the theaters that has, like, these problems solved. And so, like, some of the problems in the movie are because of that. Like, the fact that you can see Judi Dench's wedding ring, like, half the time is, like, that movie wasn't finished. Or the fact that sometimes their feet sink into the ground. Or sometimes their feet float above the ground. That was all, like, tech problem stuff. But some of the tech problems aren't that. Like, the fact that they just start wearing shoes halfway through the movie. Or, like... other shit like that. And so it's just, this is why it's, like, such a wonderful fucking mess, right? Is that it's just, like, it's profoundly riddled with technical problems, but the insanity of, like, the actual premise of the movie, like, overwhelms all of that, to me at least. Like...
I'm really impressed that Dame Judi Dench is so committed to her partner that she will not take that ring off to film. So I now think of that as a metaphor for love. You're willing to ruin a movie because you want your partner to know you love them no matter what.
It also raises the question, like, why wasn't Mr. Old Deuteronomy at the Jellicle Ball?
Oh, he's dead, right?
Yeah, probably.
It's super hard to say, but
she
also
has, like, heavy widow vibes.
Like,
I mean, she was trying to fucking, she was hitting on Gus the theater cat aggressively throughout.
That's true.
Yeah.
God, the cats were too horny.
They were so horny.
This is, yeah. When Miles and I were working on the Star Wars article, I was like, all right, so we got to make some concessions about cats. It looks pretty shitty and the cats are too horny. And then Miles was just like, no, actually, they're not horny enough. And I was like, okay, we're just going to have to table this and never.
Oh, I couldn't. If they were hornier, I would have been very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I mean, I was already
super
uncomfortable. Also, just like the inconsistency, like what was going on with the wardrobe department and who, like, okay, why were some cats wearing fur and Rebel Wilson had two layers of fur? And
yeah,
was that
why would you wear
her
other
fur or a dead cat's fur?
That would be like if you wore other skin. Like,
yes,
if right
correct.
Now you took your skin off and there was other skin underneath.
And everyone was like, oh, cool, Amanda, keep singing.
I wouldn't say that. No. I would run.
Yeah. Also, Rebel Wilson in that scene sings into like a weird pink tube. And I thought it was, like, her tail, but it's not her tail. And it's unclear whose tail it is. And it never shows up again in the movie.
So she has the skin of a cat she killed that she wears, and then she has a tail that's not hers that
that's
she sings
microphone.
Into. And she's just like, fuck with me and this will be you. And
then she eats a roach that talk like, looks at her wrong.
Like, I didn't like that, the roach eating at all.
Yeah, the roaches were too human for that to be comfortable.
The boldest swing was definitely the humanized roaches and mice. I just feel like
I'm sure I'm not the only one who just is kind of disturbed by roaches and doesn't like them. So I didn't enjoy that at all.
Even when they're dancing adorably.
No. Other quick question. Why does Victoria know the words to all the songs?
She slowly picks them up, much like the audience in the theater, I think.
Okay. That's cool. There's a couple points where I was like, she's like really harmonizing here. and about, I don't know, 40 minutes ago, she was tossed in a burlap sack into the streets of London, which I'm glad that you pointed this out, were oddly empty. So, I mean, we there's a couple big questions I think we do need to ask, or at least that I need to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with this. Two related things. Is the Jellicle Cat contingent a sort of death cult? Two, what is the heavy side? Is it heaven? Is it hell? Is it neither? Is it some purgatorial space? I don't know. Thoughts on these?
So one answer I do have is the heavy side lair is actually a reference to the heavy side layer, which is a layer of the atmosphere that T.S. Eliot just liked the sound of. But death, heaven... slash, is it heaven? Because maybe, like, as cats, they have multiple lives, so it's like reincarnation is implied.
Yeah.
But
so is it clearly a reincarnation that Jennifer Hudson cat is going to go into the atmosphere and then later come back as another cat?
That's what I got.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they say, right? Is that you go to the heavy side layer and then, like, get a new life.
Yeah, which is like a weird way of saying, like, you're a valued member of our community now. Fuck off in this tire.
Yeah, and I mean, like, she was clearly exiled and alienated from this community in a way that caused, I think trauma and psychological damage. Mm-hmm. And within minutes of being welcomed back in, they then attach her to a floating chandelier and shoot her into space.
Yeah, and like, just watching her kind of float away, it's not a feeling of joy that...
No, because, I mean, she's going to hit the sun at some point.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so funny to me in that scene where she, like, regains her, like, standing in the community, all starts because Victoria just looks at her and goes, sing. Like, just commands her to sing. And then she's like, okay.
I appreciated that. Like, thematically, there was a moment where I was like, okay, Victoria has been exiled somehow. She's lonely. She's recognizing via this empathetic gaze something similar in this other person. She wants to work to bring her back into the fold. I will say that for part of the movie, coming in with no knowledge of the musical, I thought that Victoria was going to be the belle of the Jellicle Ball.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun when it got pivoted towards the Jennifer Hudson cat. What are the Jellicles? Is this a gang? Is this a religion? Is it a cult? Is it a ethnic subset? Is it like a sort of militia based on a set of unifying political principles inherited over the generations?
Judgmental community.
Well, according to a very weird Andrew Lloyd Webber interview, all cats are Jellicle cats.
What?
That just reminds me of when I knew some people that were really, and this is fine, were evangelical in their religion, and they would say to you, you're like a pre-Christian or something like that. Like, there's no such thing as a non-Christian. There's only Christians that haven't come around yet. Once again, this isn't to make fun of any religion, but that idea that we're all already Jellicles.
Yeah, I wish I could remember who the interview was with. I know it's Andrew Lloyd Webber sitting at a piano, and he's talking to this British lady, and then she's like, what's a Jellicle cat? And he's like, well, a Jellicle cat is like, it's a cat and they can be big or small or black or white. And then she's like, okay, but like, what is and is not a Jellicle cat? And he's just like, every cat's a Jellicle cat. And she's like, then what's the thing about? And he's like, it's about also, cats. Like,
in the song,
it's a super weird interview.
I did know this earlier. In the song where they tell us what Jellicle cats are, they also say some are metaphorical cats. What is a metaphorical cat and what is the metaphor? Sorry.
I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe, like, some of the cats are, like, oof, it's tough to say. Maybe some of their names are a metaphor for something that they also do.
So if all cats are Jellicle cats,
how is Victoria an outsider?
Yeah, so is it the idea that to come to the Jellicle Ball is to reintegrate yourself into a community that you are, like, genetically already a part of?
I think it's, like all about realizing that you are a Jellicle cat. That's, like, Victoria's journey. Is like, she already was a special kitty because they're all special kitties.
Yeah.
I just like the thing with this play, the reason why, like, we compared it to Star Wars in that article is that, like, well, let me tell you, it's a fucking mess in a lot of ways. But one thing the movie does do is establish characters having wants that are opposed to their needs and then, like, having an arc that, like, gets them from one to the other. Even if that arc happens across, like, 8 minutes and two songs. But, like, it does happen, right? Like,
so, to relate to that a little bit, so do we know why does McCavity, first of all, I don't like his strategy at all. I've already talked about my problems with his song or the songs that are sung about him. So his strategy in general, this would be like if, I don't know, the Los Angeles Clippers basketball franchise wanted to win a game and Kawhi Leonard ran around and put players from the other team in, like, a secret room and then said, well, I guess we won the game today because the other team didn't show up. But it also seems like if Idris Elba Cat, I'm sorry, McCavity Cat, were to win the Jellicle Ball, he just dies. He could do that on his own.
Yeah, but you have to die the special way.
So does he want to die the special way so he can come back? And, like, so is there a pure desire there, I guess is what I'm asking. Is he too far gone in the street life and that by being reborn via the Jellicle ritual rites, he could come back and maybe, like, have a new life and be an accountant or a pastry chef or something more honorable?
That's, like, the maddening thing to me about this musical is that everyone's like, I'm amazing. Like, hear me sing about how about my many talents. And thus so I can win the prize of not being me anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Chrysabella is like the only cat for whom it seems like a good idea to go to the Heaviside Lair. Like, she's the only one who seems to need a reset. Everyone else seems like pretty okay.
Yeah. And just in terms of morality as well, I will say, just for any younger person who saw this movie and took notes, what Taylor Swift does is she doses a room of people that did not consent. So if you ever think that'd be like a funny thing at your cat theme party to make some punch and put a substance in it, don't do that. That's not a cool thing to do.
Or at least like put up a sign.
Let them know. Because that was aggressive too, that she just comes in and sings and just drugs everyone. But then they bounce back pretty quick.
Also, McCavity's disappearing powers, I think, don't really hold up to scrutiny.
Magic was weird. The rules of the magic in this world were weird.
Especially how he can specifically disappear you and then reappear you to the boat in chains. Like,
I was so confused by that, and I thought I missed something, because I thought, how do we get from the Egyptian theater Jellicle Cat place to the boat place by the Thames? As Corden lets us know, not the Thames. You can't say Thames because it rhymes with Ames, the Thames. it was a lot. The rules of magic. And then did Deuteronomy actually like magically come back? Or did she just walk back on her own power and want to make Mistopheles feel good about himself?
I think she, he magics her back.
He really magicked her back?
I think he magicked
Gotta
her back.
Gotta believe.
Okay. Okay, but just like when she rolled up, I was like, is this like a sweet parent when like a kid's learning magic tricks? And the parent's like, what is this I found, Timothy? And Timothy's like, I do magic now.
On the McCavity magic thing, that's one of my favorite bits in the movie, and I think it's on purpose that he always says something different when he does the magical spell. Like, the first time he does it, he's just like, ineffable. And then later he's like, magic. And then another one, he just goes, meow. And on a different one, he just says, McCavity. And it's never the same. And it's, to me, very good. And very funny. Also, it's very weird that Idris Elba is so buff that his cat looks insane.
It's intimidating.
Yeah. His cat is the only one with a visible six-pack.
Yeah, his cat body's jacked. And all the other cats are
so very flat. So there's one cat-sized set of weights in all of London, and McCavity has said, them are mine. I will muscle myself.
Yeah, McCavity just like, McCavity them to his like special lair and like did it up.
Well, as we start to, you know, work our way to our own heavy side of sorts, who do you think, and this is maybe backing up a little bit and we can dive back in because I want to make sure everyone says all the deep things this movie inspired in their fragile brains, but who regrets making this movie most? Out of the actors that are in it, who do we think saw that first cut, hung their head, and thought, oh, no?
My vote is James Corden, just because I heard a story that James Corden showed up for the premiere, did the red carpet, and then left before the screening.
Oh, wow.
Which either is like he's a busy dude, or like is Tim just being like, get me out of here.
I mean, the
also his portrayal is not the nicest one.
And the cat body shaming is pretty out of control.
If he was a human, he would just be a foodie. We live in a culture where if you just like love food all the time, that's like a cool thing and you could start a blog and monetize it. But in the cat world, Corden loves snacking and we treat him like he's some big asshole.
Yeah.
Are you going with Corden as well, Amanda, for the
that
person?
That was kind of my first instinct as well, yeah.
Okay, now that I know this premiere thing, it makes me want to change my answer. I couldn't help but think Idris Elba. Because in terms of people, when they're outside of their cat suits, he's kind of like a cool guy.
Yeah.
He like DJs at parties in Ibiza. He occasionally will drop a verse on a grime song in England. He was in The Wire, among other things. And when he first pops up, he's the most where I'm like, I just don't know how they got him to do this.
Do you think he feels like a little bit disgusted with himself when he's out there like dropping that cat's money on like a new Hampton's house or something?
Maybe he burned it.
I just think this production was probably pretty fun to do and didn't take that long from the actors. Like, they just had to throw on green screen suits, get on green screen, sing and spin around and like goof off. And then like everything else happened in post. So like, to me, it's like someone was like, Idris Elba, we'll give you $5 million to come here for a week, sing a couple songs, say different weird catchphrases, and then you can leave. And he was just like, fine, sounds great. Like, Like, it's a, it seems like a fun gig.
Fair enough. On the flip side, really quick, do you think there's anyone who was in this movie, made the movie, and is like, yeah, you know what? That was pretty good.
I heard that Taylor Swift said, claimed to have enjoyed it.
Okay.
I bet the ballet man who played Skimbleshanks came out of this feeling good, because they just, like, killed it, and they're only in the movie for a little tiny bit. They just, like, show up, do a cool dance, sing a cool song, and leave. And I bet he was just, like, nailed it. Like, that's that's how you cats, baby.
A lot of Twitter love for Skimbleshanks, for sure.
Wow. So, any final thoughts as you ride the metaphorical chandelier towards the empty space of the Heaviside?
So,
final thoughts.
Did this movie remind either of you guys of, like, weird, like, French extreme, like, Holy Motors type shit? Like, obviously not as good or, like, thoughtful or, like, intellectually riveting, but, like, the way that everything, like, looked wrong and was, like you said, Amanda, like, really surreal and, like, played with, like, your sense of reality, whether on purpose or not. Like, it had that energy to me that, like, you can, like, generously assume it's on purpose and it's, like, a pretty fun, wild thing. It seems like probably it's not. But I don't know. I kind of really liked how I mean, literally when I saw it the second time, a friend of mine was like, this movie, like, it looks like Holy Motors, reminds me of Holy Motors, let's go see it. And then we see it again, and I was like, yeah, I kind of can see where you're coming from. Just like the animated overlay parts of Holy Motors.
No, I see that. I definitely think there's some accidental, surreal art, question mark, happening, for sure.
Well, this has been a journey. So to step away from cats for a second, let's get in touch with the most important part of this podcast, our listeners. And hit the mailbag and the voicemail. So just a quick reminder. Well, first of all, quick affirmation. We love hearing from you. Y'all are the best. Please do not hesitate to email and call. You can email us at movies@wisecrack.co. No M, wisecrack.co. Or you can call us at 213-534-8807. That's 213-534-8807. We truly love to hear from you. It's not a bit or a joke or a lie. So please tell us what you think. So we have some messages about last week where we talked about Uncut Gems. Have y'all seen that movie?
Oh, yes. Fucking yeah, dude.
Awesome. Well, feel free to jump in on this. So let's start with an email we have from Jason. He says this, I'm not writing about any one film in particular, but rather a handful of films that came out in 2019, including Parasite, Us, Joker, Ready or Not, and Knives Out, to name a few. It's hard not to notice that the thematic similarity between all these movies is how people of varying economic classes interact with, harm, and understand one another. From the more surface-level commentary in Ready or Not about a wealthy family that hunts a lower-class individual, to the far more nuanced take in Parasite about the futility of trying to rise above your station in life, the idea of class structures was clearly in the zeitgeist last year. I'm wondering if you guys think this trend was purely coincidental or if it's indicative of the social and wealth gap that continues to grow between classes and many people's dissatisfaction with that. Love you guys and everything you do. Peace, Jason.
Well, I feel like Jason's going to be pretty stoked on the new script that you're working on, which is literally about how the prevalence of class conflict in 2019 films. But yeah, I definitely feel like it's, I mean, especially the fact that, like, a foreign film like Parasite was able to become so incredibly mainstream, I feel like just shows the, like, worldwide resonance of class.
Yeah, and the Parasite thing's interesting because there's an interview, and y'all can look this up, where Bong Joon-ho says something to the effect of, like, I thought I was making a movie about a particular place, like the contemporary Seoul, South Korea, and realized he was just making a movie about the world that we all live in.
Yeah.
So this idea that, like, certain social conditions are so universal that it's affecting art made on other sides of the world.
Yeah.
I thought I was making a movie about Korea. Turns out we all live in the same country. It's called capitalism, I believe.
Yeah.
I mean, I forget who said it. I want to say Freud because it has the word anxiety in it, but it probably wasn't Freud. But, like, art tends to reflect the anxieties of the culture that created it, right? Like, that's like a pretty historically accepted truism. And it seems very clear that in 2019, 2020 Earth, like, class is, like, the big problem. I mean, it has been for a long time, but it's becoming more obviously the big problem than it was in past times. And so I think it's not a coincidence. I think you're going to see more of that stuff going forward because, like, more and more, the story that everyone feels that really resonates and the story that affects people and moves people is like the one of their own crisis. And the crisis right now is like a massive class crisis, especially in America, but like pretty globally.
Yeah. And it's just an interesting point in general. If you're ever doing your like film history, you go back to certain periods, like films made in the late 60s, early 70s. We see, you know, the influence of the Vietnam War, whether explicitly or implicitly, and a lot of the themes being explored there. The movies made in like the sort of boom times of the 80s. On the backs of all this economic growth, you'll notice certain themes of like affluence and over the topness. Also, Weekend at Bernie's in that period. So there's a fun kind of like sociology of film you can do by watching a set of movies and asking like what was going on in the world at that time.
And like in correlation with right now, I mean, like right out during or maybe slightly after the Great Depression, there were like a good amount of films exploring similar themes to what we're seeing right now, which. Like Grapes of Wrath, Sullivan's Travels.
That's great. Well, Jason, thank you so much for that. Really insightful question. And yeah, there's a video coming out probably next week, maybe after that I think you'll maybe like.
I think it's a week from Wednesday, but I can't remember.
Okay.
Which is, well, Jason, I should know this.
Just subscribe and keep up with it. Yeah. Let's hit some voicemails real quick. So this one is from Jacob.
To me the meaning, Wisecraft crew. My name is Jacob, calling in regards to your Uncut Gems podcast. I really enjoyed the movie, and I think it was one of Adam Sandler's best, but it really got me thinking about the resurgence of the neo-gangster drama, or the genre itself. In the film, we see him like dealing with gangsters, and we see him dealing with a lot of people, and it got me really thinking with other movies, mostly films like John Wick, The Irishman, this resurgence of a almost long-forgotten genre, and for almost like it's going to be replacing the superhero genre. And I really wanted to know what you guys thought, since, you know, the superhero, like, bubble is going to be, like, well, no one's going to want to be seeing any more superhero movies.
So, interesting point.
Dude, I am down for gangsters to replace superheroes, like... Sign me up, man.
Yeah, it sounds like an upgrade, but I also don't think it's gonna happen. Just like, even you look at the list of movies that Jacob pointed out, which are all do have similarities, they also all have like very fundamental differences in terms of like type of movie and goal, right? Like The Irishman's a movie largely about like this question of like how hard do you work for people who don't give a shit about you, right? And then Uncut Gems is a movie about like is really just an experiment in like how hard can we induce a panic attack in an audience by like tricking them into liking this guy and begging for him to live a better life. And then John Wick just is like a cool fucking shoot 'em up movie. So like, I think maybe there is some truth to what he's saying that of like bringing movies down in scale, right? Away from like 200 million fucking Endgame movies. But I think that even within the movies they listed, it's such a diversity of type of movie that I think we might see a shrinking in scale, but I don't think we're going to see a sort of genre consolidation in the way that he's talking about.
I feel like, especially like the directors of Uncut Gems, the Safdie brothers, should I say that right?
Yes.
I feel like we are seeing maybe it's a good time for like scumbag protagonists.
Good time,
which brings me to the Safdie brothers' incredible first film, Good Time, which is a very similar narrative to Uncut Gems, except I think better.
This isn't time for hot takes.
Okay, sorry.
Turn the temperature on. No, but once again, I think very interesting question posed by Jacob. And I like kind of between y'all, I don't know if it'll come back and overtake superheroes, but I do like the intensity of seeing gangsters in a contemporary setting, because so many gangster movies historically have been like, oh, 30 years ago when that was a thing. And I think Uncut Gems does a good job of being like, oh, there's still like goons today that could find you. So be careful. Oh, we have one last voicemail we're going to dip into today. This is from Nick.
Hey, my name's Nick. I just watched the Uncut Gems podcast, and that movie is really surprising. I downloaded it right before I got on a flight. And I'm sitting on this flight watching this movie so engrossed because there's no distractions around me or anything else going on. Just, like, the stewardess had to tap on my shoulder a couple times to get my attention because I had headphones on. I was so engrossed in this movie every step of the way. They did a fantastic job with it. And even at the end, that final basketball game, I'm sitting there, like, rooting for the Celtics. I don't care about basketball 7 days out of the week, but during that movie, I was so engrossed and wanted him to win so badly. They, like, the Celtics scored, and I was like, I kind of pumped my fist. I was really excited for him, and I looked over, and the lady is, like, kind of looking at me.
I want to be on a flight with Nick.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really good point. There's something about the effect that Uncut Gems has on a viewer that's super unique. Did anyone else feel like you got caught up in your own world or found yourself being a temporary Celtics fan from 2012?
Okay, well, a fun fact about this is this movie takes place during a time when I was writing about basketball as, like, a job. So the game that it's showing is a game that, like, I fully knew who won and, like, what Kevin Garnett did and, like, knew all the facts about the game and was still fucking losing my damn mind in the theater while I was watching it. Like, in the back of my head, I was like, I know the Celtics win. Like, I know Garnett, like, tops 26 points or rebounds total because he gets, I think, 18 and 13. Like, I, like, knew all that shit, and I still was freaking the fuck out, like, throughout the entire sequence just because, like, the movie, it's like I said, like, the movie does this incredible job of giving you a guy who's just likable enough and has just enough redeeming qualities that you're like, you could get out of this by just being less of a scumbag for 10 seconds. And then he keeps having opportunities to be less of a scumbag and always chooses no. But you like him just enough that you, like, keep having faith. And then at that end moment is so perfect because Eric Bogosian's character lives out the arc the audience is living, right? Like, at the end, when the Celtics win, he's like, oh my God, he fucking did it. Like, I actually can just, like, get the money from him. We can go back to being friends because he's, like, a fine guy and we'll be okay. And it's like, no, you can't. Like, blammo, he's dead. Oh. Spoilers. But, like, it's the whole movie is like that. Like, it's constantly stressing you out and making you more and more anxious for Adam Sandler to the point where even things that, like, have obvious endpoints or, like, known endpoints, if you're me, like, still affect you tremendously. And then it gives you that little gasp of joy before it just rips it all away, which is brutal, brutal piece of filmmaking. I fucking love that movie.
And I mean, same with Good Time. It takes you in, like, a compressed time period with a scumbag character who you can't help but empathize with or at least, like, care about, and it just does not let up for 30 seconds. Like, yeah, I was freaking out the entire time.
Yeah, so thank you for sharing that.
They do a good job of, like, dramatizing, like, safe space. Like, you get to the Passover dinner and then it's like everything seems fine. It's like cut to Arno is there and you're like, oh fuck. Or, like, they go to the school play and it's like pans over and it's like the thugs are there and you're like, I thought we were gonna relax for a second.
And, like, so I think our main takeaway is double feature Cats and Uncut Gems. Your local theater should do it. Once again, we would love to hear from you. Please let us know your thoughts on Cats after this, especially if you know about, like, mating rituals, age of consent, whether magic is real for cats, if the Jellicles are a cult or just a group we should accept. Movies at wisecrack.co is how you can email us. Voicemail 213-534-8807. We have been your Jellicle host, Amanda, Lux. I've been Michael. And thank you so much for hanging out with us on Show Me the Meaning. We'll be back soon. In the meantime, subscribe, like, rate, review, all those great things. And have a great week, everyone.
Later, guys.
Later, dudes.